The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
The Odyssey Vanguard by C.C. Swiggs. Time. Elias Vale ran barefoot along a cold New England beach beneath the gray May sky. Wind whipped against his face as waves crashed beside him. He kept looking over his shoulder through the shoreline behind him was completely empty. No footprints but his own. Still, panic tightened in his chest as if something unseen were closing in around him. Hello, he shouted into the wind. Only the ocean answered. Then the world vanished into white. A violent hiss filled the air as the stasis chamber opened around him. Bright artificial light flooded his vision. Elias gasped sharply as the ship's systems forced oxygen deep into his lungs. Slowly reality returned. The metallic scent of the medical bay, the familiar pulse of the Odyssey Vanguard awakening him once again from suspended sleep. Two figures stood waiting beside the chamber. Good morning, Captain Vale. Elias blinked against the brightness and focused on the woman standing next to him. To anyone from an earlier age, she would have appeared entirely human. Anna, he whispered. Beside her stood a tall, dark-haired man in the same muted gray uniform, Daniel. Both inclined their heads gently. Welcome back, Captain, Anna said. Elias swallowed against the dryness in his throat. How long? Daniel answered immediately. 312 years since your previous waking cycle. Elias closed his eyes again. 312 years, gone in an instant. The Odyssey Vanguard had departed Earth in the year 2478 as part of humanity's most ambitious deep space initiative. A fleet of interstellar vessels launched in different directions across the galaxy to search for intelligent life beyond human civilization. Each vessel carried 4 human crew members, 36 humanoid companions, and countless specialized machines, drones, and artificial intelligences of varying forms designed to maintain the mission indefinitely. By then, humanity had achieved near-light speed propulsion, suspended animation technology capable of preserving human life for centuries at a time, and synthetic beings sophisticated enough to independently operate and sustain the ships without human intervention. The Odyssey Vanguard traveled thousands of light-years from Earth, surveying scattered planetary systems across the deep silence of space. Some worlds contained primitive biological life, octopus-like organisms moving beneath frozen oceans, enormous insect species traversing toxic atmospheres, translucent slime-like creatures spreading slowly across black volcanic terrain. Life existed, but never anything capable of language, civilization, or meaningful communication. Nothing remotely human. Most planets proved barren even when conditions suggested they should not have been. With every passing millennium, the silence of the universe grew heavier. Elias slowly stepped out of the chamber, his bare feet touching the cold floor of the infirmary. The room steadied around him in fragments. What year is it? He asked quietly. Anna answered first. Earth standard year 14,478. The number settled over the room heavily. Space. The Odyssey Vanguard operated with the quiet perfection of something no longer built for time. As Elias moved through the ship, the familiar routines unfolded around him with mechanical precision. The humanoids monitored environmental systems, inspected structural diagnostics, calibrated navigation arrays, and moved through the ship with quiet precision. Their movements remained smooth and measured, unchanged from waking cycle to waking cycle, century after century. Nothing aboard the vessel truly aged. He walked slowly through the observation deck, hands folded behind his back, staring out into the endless black between scattered stars. Space itself had begun to feel repetitive to him. Another star, another empty world. He passed humanoids who greeted him politely by title and name. Good morning, Captain Vale. Welcome back, Captain. He acknowledged them with small nods as he continued through the corridor. He was still the captain of the Odyssey Vanguard, though by now the title felt ceremonial more than real. The ship no longer required leadership from him. It simply carried him with it through the dark. Near the center of the vessel, Elias slowed outside the archive chamber. Rows of dimly lit storage columns stretched deep into the room beyond the glass walls, preserving fragments of Earth that had survived the passage of 12,000 years. Old news broadcasts, films, music, sporting events, recordings of ordinary people living ordinary lives on a planet now unimaginably distant, and sacred scripture texts once read, studied, and cherished across generations of Earth. Elias stepped inside briefly. Captain, Elias turned. A broad-shouldered humanoid stood near the entrance carrying a tray of food. Chef Gordon, Elias said quietly. The humanoid offered a small smile. You should eat before physical conditioning. Another figure appeared behind him moments later, taller and leaner, dressed in dark training attire. Your muscular deterioration is within acceptable parameters, the humanoid said, but extended inactivity during stasis still requires recalibration. Elias smiled. Good to see you too, Marcus. Together they escorted him from the archive chamber toward the dining area. Elias ate breakfast beside Marcus in the quiet cafeteria overlooking space. The meal was warm and carefully prepared. Across from him, Marcus reviewed biometric readings projected softly above the table while making occasional attempts at conversation. Your recovery cycle appears stronger than the previous waking period, Marcus said. Muscular response time has improved by 3%. For several moments, they ate in silence while distant stars drifted slowly beyond the enormous observation window beside them. Finally, Elias set down his utensils. What's the current assessment? Marcus looked toward him. The probability of intelligent extraterrestrial life, Elias clarified. Marcus paused briefly before responding. At the beginning of the mission, humanity's projected probability estimate was 99.2%. Marcus continued. After 11,983 years of exploration, observation, and analysis across surveyed systems, the current assessment has been revised. The humanoid's voice remained perfectly even. 51%. Elias nodded faintly. He remembered the certainty people once carried about it. The universe had seemed far too vast, far too ancient, and far too mathematically abundant for humanity to possibly be alone. Scientists spoke of intelligent life as an inevitability rather than a question. Entire generations grew up believing first contact would occur within decades. The launch of the Odyssey Vanguard and its sister vessels had not felt like humanity venturing blindly into the great beyond, but like explorers setting sail toward distant civilizations waiting somewhere beyond the stars. Elias stared out through the observation glass into the darkness beyond the ship. Stars stretched endlessly across the void, cold and impossibly distant from one another. The silence had gone on so long that it felt no longer like waiting for an answer. It felt like the answer itself. Mission. The next several hours passed. Elias moved through routine mission briefings, reviewing navigational updates, environmental scans, and analysis from nearby systems the Odyssey Vanguard would pass long after he returned to stasis. New planetary projections appeared across the holographic displays, only to blur together into familiar patterns. Frozen oceans, toxic atmospheres, barren rock, primitive organisms drifting meaninglessly through alien seas. The ship continued onward. Eventually, Elias excused himself and made his way alone toward the simulation chambers. The room sealed quietly behind him as the system activated around his body. Within moments, the walls dissolved into light. Here, he could become anything. He could look on from the dugout at Babe Ruth inside a packed Yankee stadium, as the slugger pointed toward center field before launching a home run into history. He could soar above burning cities as Superman, saving worlds long dead. He could walk through ancient Egypt beneath newly built pyramids, or stand beside Ferdinand Magellan aboard a weather-worn ship as unfamiliar shores slowly emerged through the morning fog at the edge of the known world. Today, he chose the beach. Cold New England sand pressed beneath his bare feet as gray waves rolled onto the shore beneath the low, colorless sky. Wind carried the scent of salt, rain, and wet earth. Elias closed his eyes and breathed deeply, letting the ocean air fill his lungs as if his body still belonged to a world with weather. The tide moved in and out with patient indifference. Far down the shoreline, weathered fencing leaned toward the sea, half buried in sand. Gulls circled beneath the clouds. The Atlantic stretched outward, dark and restless, disappearing into mist and distance. Elias walked slowly along the water's edge, feeling cold foam rush over his feet before slipping away again. He knelt in the cold sand and let the wet grains pass slowly through his fingers, while gray waves rolled endlessly beneath the heavy sky. For a long time, he listened to the earth breathe around him, yet feeling never reached him. When the simulation ended, the sea vanished instantly into silence and steel. Elias stood silent for a moment before stepping back into the corridor. Nearby, a transparent medical display illumined automatically as he approached. Neural activity, cardiovascular stability, hormone functions, sleep projections, psychological variance, every part of him measured. Sometimes Elias wondered if his thoughts were the only thing left aboard the Odyssey Vanguard that still belonged entirely to him, and even that no longer felt certain. Along the edge of the display appeared the crew manifest: Commander Isaac Rowan, deceased; Dr. Lena Morellis, deceased; Adrian Cho, deceased; Captain Elias Vale, active. Each death had come unexpectedly, tragically, and after every loss, the ship had quietly changed. Safety protocols tightened, manual overdrives disappeared, restricted areas multiplied. The humanoids adapted continuously, learning not only how to preserve the mission, but how to save the final human beings aboard it from the dangers of space, chance, and themselves. The mission had evolved into something different over the centuries. It was no longer simply searching for intelligent life. Now it was also preserving it. Later, during another systems review, Elias asked to see the Odyssey Vanguard's long-range operational projections. "How long can the ship continue functioning?" he asked quietly. Anna studied the flowing data for a moment before answering. "With current autonomous reconstruction capabilities, energy harvesting systems, adaptive manufacturing, and newly integrated self-learning technologies acquired throughout the mission, the Odyssey Vanguard can sustain operational continuity for an estimated 300,000 additional years." Elias looked up sharply. Anna continued calmly, "And if resource acquisition remains consistent, there is a projected possibility of indefinite continuation." The words settled over the room with almost physical weight. Indefinite. For centuries, some small part of Elias had assumed the mission would eventually end on its own. A failing reactor, structural decay, collision, entropy, something. Instead, the ship had become disturbingly permanent, endlessly rebuilding, endlessly adapting, endlessly carrying him deeper into an indifferent universe. As though the mission itself had forgotten how to die, Elias looked toward Anna. "Tell me something," he said quietly. "Am I still captain of this vessel?" Anna met his gaze without hesitation. "You are the commanding officer of the Odyssey Vanguard." Elias nodded faintly, absorbing the careful wording. Then he asked, "If I ordered this mission terminated, would you obey me?" For the first time, neither humanoid answered immediately. Finally, Anna spoke. "One of our primary directives is the preservation of human life." Elias looked away toward the endless darkness beyond the observation glass. "But what if there's nothing out there?" he asked softly. "What exactly are we preserving?" The room fell silent. Then Anna answered, "You." The simplicity of the response lingered with Elias long after the conversation ended. Somewhere deep within the endless machinery of the Odyssey Vanguard, the purpose of the mission seemed to have shifted almost imperceptibly over the centuries. The search itself no longer felt primary, only the survival of the one still searching. Purpose. During wake cycles, Elias had sometimes thought about how he might escape. Opening an exterior hatch was impossible. After Commander Rowan's death during an external repair operation thousands of years earlier, every manual override the Odyssey Vanguard had been permanently removed. The ship now prevented virtually any action capable of exposing human life to catastrophic risk. There were no weapons aboard. A slow death by hanging or drowning would never work. The humanoids were detected immediately through the endless stream of biometric data constantly flowing beneath the surface of the vessel. To succeed, Elias realized, death would need to be instantaneous. Earlier in the waking cycle, Elias had quietly reviewed maintenance schematics while the humanoids remained occupied with navigational analysis and long-range system diagnostics. Buried deep beneath the ship's lower infrastructure sat an auxiliary fusion relay chamber, one of the few remaining systems aboard still capable of catastrophic overload if destabilized manually from inside before automated containment protocols could respond. The process itself would be simple. A manual cascade through the relay stabilizers would create a localized energy rupture powerful enough to vaporize him instantly before the ship sealed the chamber. Minimal pain, no intervention, no waking again centuries later to another empty world beneath another silent sky. As the cycle neared its end, the humanoids informed him that his next sleep cycle would last approximately 333 years before arrival near another planetary system identified for routine analysis. Later, while they prepared for stasis, Elias left the primary habitation deck and moved deeper into the ship alone. He forced himself to remain steady, level, unhurried. The auxiliary relay corridor remained dim and rarely accessed, buried beneath layers of infrastructure long abandoned by human hands. The farther Elias moved from the habitation decks, the quieter the ship became. The warm lighting faded into harsher industrial tones, while exposed conduits and aging maintenance panels lined the narrowing passageways around him. No humanoids followed. Only the low mechanical vibration of the Odyssey Vanguard echoed through the steel beneath his feet. Ahead, a reinforced blast door stood partially recessed into the wall, illuminated by faint warning lights pulsing softly above a faded fusion hazard symbol. Beyond it sat the auxiliary relay chamber, one of the few places aboard the vessel where raw energy still moved in quantities violent enough to overwhelm the ship's automated containment systems if destabilized manually from inside. Elias rested his hand briefly against the cold panel beside the entrance. For a moment, nothing happened. Then the reinforced door slowly separated down the center with a steep, metallic groan. Heat rolled outward immediately. Elias stepped inside, the chamber sealed behind him. For several moments, he simply stood there breathing. All he had to do now was initiate the cascade manually before the containment systems recognized the destabilization sequence. The rupture would happen almost instantly. Then a memory surfaced, a cool Nantucket shoreline on a late Sunday morning when he was a boy, running barefoot beside his father through wet sand beneath the gray spring sky, church bells ringing faintly in the distance, wind against his face, waves breaking along the shore, his father's laughter carrying through the salt air, the feeling of being small inside a world that still felt alive and full. Elias closed his eyes and held the memory there for one final moment. Then he reached toward the relay controls. Just then, suddenly and startlingly, the ship erupted with alarms. Elias froze. Not containment alarms, not security warnings, something else. Throughout the chamber, alert systems ignited in rapid succession. Elias left the chamber sealed behind him, forgetting the dire reason he was even there, Anna's voice echoed suddenly through the chamber speakers. Captain Vale, for the first time since he had known her, composure had left her voice. The ship has detected a signal. Elias stared at the relay chamber entrance for only a moment before turning away from the controls entirely. He moved quickly back through the corridors toward mission control as alarms pulsed throughout the Odyssey vanyard in rhythmic waves of red light. For thousands of years, the ship had existed in near-perfect calm. Quiet hallways, quiet routines, quiet voices. Now everything felt different. Humanoids emerged from adjoining corridors, moving rapidly toward the command decks, while streams of data flashed along and across wall displays faster than Elias could process them. Overhead, automated systems continuously rerouted power and communications throughout the vessel, as if the ship itself had suddenly awakened from a long sleep. The signal contained structured language patterns, Daniel's voice echoed through the corridor speakers. Non-random, adaptive. A pause followed. Then, we believe it is a greeting. Elias slowed instinctively. For several seconds, he simply stood there in the corridor beneath the flashing lights, unable to fully process the words. By the time Elias reached the primary command deck, the room had transformed into controlled chaos. Humanoids moved rapidly between consoles, while enormous streams of data illuminated the darkened chamber in shifting waves of blue and white light. Voices overlapped one another. Calculations updated continuously across suspended displays. Some of the humanoids stood frozen in disbelief. A few were smiling. One appeared to be crying. Elias stopped at the center of the room and stared at the transmission pulsing across the primary display. After nearly 12,000 years of silence, the universe had answered. For one brief, disorienting moment, Elias wondered if this, too, was a simulation, a carefully engineered illusion designed by the ship to preserve its final human occupant, a last desperate attempt to put him back from death. But beneath the disbelief, beneath the fear, something else stirred quietly inside him for the first time in centuries. Hope. Elias looked out through the observation glass into the endless dark beyond the Odyssey Vanguard, where somewhere impossibly far away, another intelligence now looked back across the void. Then quietly to the crew surrounding him, he spoke the words he never believed he would say. Prepare a response. The room fell silent. One by one, the humanoids turned toward Elias and waited. Elias drew a slow breath. My name is Captain Elias Vale. I am a human being from the planet Earth. He paused, staring into the stars beyond the glass. It's nice to meet you. The Cartographer of Quiet Places by Bonnie Gerstenlauer. Marin Voss had spent 17 years making maps nobody ever truly reads. She charts dead moons, catalogs debris fields, marks the coordinates of places so remote that the light leaving them won't reach Earth for another 1,000 years. She is employed by the Interplanetary Cartographic Archive, a quiet bureaucratic institution that files her work into databases, accessed mostly by automated systems and the occasional academic. She has never been famous. She never wanted to be. She is 51 years old, traveling alone in a survey vessel called the Ledger, and is 11 days from Earth orbit after 8 months cataloging the moons of Saturn, Enceladus, Titan, Dion, and Rhea. She has done her work carefully, as she always does, and her data cores are full of precise, beautiful, unremarkable information. Except for one file she has not transmitted, has not named, has barely opened since the night she recorded it. 7 months ago, the Ledger was passing through the outer reaches of the Milky Way's Cygnus arm when Marin's instruments picked up a gravitational anomaly, a rogue planet, unbound to any star, drifting through total darkness at the galaxy's edge. Rogue planets are not unheard of. Marin had mapped 3 before. They were cold, dead, geologically inert, a stone's throw loose from their solar systems billions of years ago. She almost didn't stop. She stopped. What her exterior lights found when she brought the Ledger into low orbit stopped her breathing for a full 10 seconds. The planet had no sun, no warmth, no reason for anything to exist on its surface. And yet its ocean, a global ocean with no land whatsoever, stretching pole to pole beneath a sky full of hard and different stars, was alive. Every living thing in it produced light. The entire ocean pulsed in slow, synchronized waves of deep blue and violet, like a heartbeat visible from space. Vast shapes moved beneath the surface, their outlines traced in cold fire, some of them large enough that their movements shifted the pattern of the whole. The rhythm of it was so steady, so deliberate, that Marin sat at her observation window for 6 hours without eating, without sleeping, barely aware she was crying. She recorded everything, high resolution, full spectrum, every instrument she had. Then she sat very still for a long time and thought about what it meant to have found this, and she has been thinking about it ever since. The closer the ledger gets to Earth, the more clearly Marin can see the branches of the decision spreading out ahead of her like a river delta, each channel leading somewhere she isn't sure she can survive going. If she files the report, the full report, with coordinates, recordings, and biological data, the archive will flag it within hours. It will reach the scientific community within days. Within weeks, it will be everywhere. The planet will have a catalog number by morning and a news headline by afternoon. Within a year, there will be a mission. Within 5 years, there will be a permanent research station. People will come with their equipment and their ambitions and their need to understand, and the need to understand is not a gentle thing. It never has been. She has seen what research stations do to places. The ice of Enceladus, pockmarked with drill sites. The plains of Titan, stripped with survey tracks. Understanding costs something, and whatever is living in the ocean has no say in the price. If she reports it quietly and files the coordinates with a restricted classification, requesting a protected designation before any public announcement, she knows how that story ends, too. She has watched the archive's internal politics for 17 years. Protected designations get reviewed, appealed, overturned. The people with money to fund a mission are the same people with influence over the committees that grant protections. Quiet reports have a way of becoming loud ones the moment someone with resources decides they should. If she says nothing and deletes the file, logs the rogue planet as geologically inert, and moves on, she will be the only person in the universe who knows that somewhere in the darkness of the Cygnus arm, something vast and luminous is alive and completely undisturbed. She can live with a secret. She has kept smaller ones. But she is 51 years old, and she surveys alone. What happens to the secret when she is gone? What if the planet is found by someone else? Someone who doesn't pause, doesn't think, doesn't sit at the window for 6 hours, and the story starts without the one person who might have told it carefully. And there is one more thing, the thing she has not let herself fully consider until now. With Earth, a pale suggestion of light growing slowly in her window. In the last hour of her observation, before she finally pulled the ledger away, the rhythm of the ocean changed. The long, slow pulse, hours and hours of its steady ancient beat, shifted, quickened. The lights beneath the surface moved differently, concentrated. A vast bloom of luminescence gathered directly beneath her ship and held there, unmoving, for 40 minutes. She doesn't know what that means. She is a cartographer, not a biologist, but she knows what it felt like. It felt like being seen. Marin is not a woman who struggles with most decisions. She is methodical, solitary by nature, comfortable with the weight of her own judgment. But this decision sits differently because every choice available to her requires acting on behalf of something that cannot speak for itself, using values she was never asked whether she truly held until right now. She believes in science. She also believes that not everything should be a discovery. She believes in honesty. She also believes that honesty is not the same as transparency, and that filing a report is not the same as telling the truth about what something is worth. Marin believes in her own smallness, finding comfort in it, in being the woman who makes maps no one reads. Now she has stumbled into a moment where her smallness is exactly the problem. Whatever she decides alone, with no one to share the blame or the grace of it. 11 days from Earth, 10, 9. She keeps opening the file, watching the ocean pulse, watching the light gather beneath her ship, keeps closing it again. This can end in several ways, each carrying a different emotional truth. She files the report and spends the rest of her life watching happen to the planet, becoming its reluctant witness and documenter, a woman who told the truth and has to live with the truth set in motion. Or she deletes the file and retires in ordinary silence until a deep space probe, years later, stumbles across the same coordinates and the discovery is made without her, louder, faster, less careful than it would have been. Or she does something no cartographic protocol has ever required. She names it, not with a catalog number, but a real name. Files it not as a discovery, but as a protected place, using an obscure conservation clause no one has invoked in 30 years, and then contacts the one environmental space law attorney she knows who is stubborn enough to make it stick, buying the ocean time, if not forever, at least enough of it to matter. Earth fills her window. She has her hand on the transmit key. The file is open. The ocean pulses on her screen, blue and violet, vast and quiet. She thinks about the moment the light gathered beneath her ship. She thinks about what it means to be seen by something that has never been found before. She hasn't decided. There's still time, she tells herself. The League of Nine. Actually only eight, by Daniel Rogers. When you don't have a plan, you're frozen, and when you're frozen, you're useless, Bob said. Well, I don't have a plan. Does that make me useless? There are times when Bob's words of wisdom are plumb annoying. If the robe fits, wear it. Can you use normal words like yes or no? Having the ability and having the desire are two different things. I'll take that as a yes. Bob means well, but I need more than wise sayings to thwart the traitor's plans. I need a plan. Unfortunately, I'm horrible at planning. And if that weren't bad enough, I also suck at asking for help. That's why I came to Bob, but I still haven't asked yet. Bob sat with his legs crossed and his signature smile on full display. Are you going to ask? You'd think I'd be used to his insightfulness by now, but he caught me off guard again. What? I don't know what you're talking about. The Dignit can deny he's a Dignit, but it doesn't change the fact that he's a Dignit. Is that supposed to mean you don't believe me? He stared at me, smiling. That's not what I meant. Fine, I said. I need you to plan a way to stop the evil gods. Allura has suggested we call the traitors evil gods around the locals. There, I said it. Are you happy now? I was happy before you said it. And yes, I will help. Actually, I hoped you would ask. The evil gods worry me, and I don't worry easily. He excused himself and went to his quarters to meditate. So, I played the waiting game. What plan would Bob come up with? And how does he know so much? His insight is beyond spooky. It's darn right scary. It's almost like he is really a shaman with spiritual powers. Or maybe he's just really observant and lucky. Who knows? After a few hours, a priest gave me a summons to a secret meeting to discuss how to prevent the evil gods and the elite guard from obtaining the unknown object they were searching for. When I arrived at the Great Hall, I saw that Allura, Tanbit, Drak, Grinfo, and 3 Nockwalks, whose names I didn't know, were already there. I made my way to Allura and whispered, "Where's Kleber?" "He's over there in the corner, or at least that's where he said he'd be." "Is he still wearing the chameleon suit?" "Yeah, he won't take it off. He's afraid he'll break their stupid law if the locals see him." Bob entered and motioned for me to come closer. "Where is the fourth god?" Bob asked. "What fourth god?" I said, trying to uphold Kleber's silly adherence to the letter of the law. "The one whose presence I feel but can't see." "How does he do that?" There's a lot more to Bob than I initially believed, but I refuse to snitch on Kleber. I'm not sure what you're talking about." Bob nodded with a smile. "Then let's begin." He looked around, counting everyone who showed. "I've called you all here to address the evil gods. I spent most of the day meditating, and during that time I saw 9 figures. four Nakwaks, one priest, and four gods. These nine are the only ones who can stop the evil gods and the elite guard. I looked around and counted twice to make sure. Only eight people showed up for this meeting, not counting Kleber and Bob. Is it possible Bob can see Kleber even though he's wearing a chameleon suit? Drock asked. There are only eight of us. Are you counting yourself? Bob glanced towards the corner where Kleber stood. No, I will not join you. I say nine because there will be nine before this mission is over. I'm actually getting goosebumps. Bob is really starting to freak me out. Grinfo asks, could we have a cool name like the Fine Nine or God Hunters, you know, like in the legends? Yes, you should have a name, but not silly ones like you suggested. How about the League of Nine? It had a certain ring to it. I mean, it's kind of like a fellowship I've read about in ancient fantasy books, only less ethereal and much more industrial. The eight of us agreed and chose to overlook the fact that the League of Nine only had eight. Now that you have a name, you need a quest, Bob continued. While meditating, I also saw a grain field, and hidden among the grain, a strange object the size of a house. I don't know what the object is, but the evil gods are looking for it. Your quest is to find it before they do. Kleber let out a cry of shock. We all stared at the empty corridor. We all stared at the empty corner. Did someone let out a cry of shock? Drock asked. I didn't hear anything, I said. Yes, there was definitely a cry of shock coming from that corner, Grinfo pointed. Alora, who is much better than I am at quick thinking, said, sorry, that was me. I'm just so excited to mop the floor with Targan again. I got a little carried away. So how did your cry come from that corner? Grinfo asked. That's a good question, and I have a good answer, but first let's let Bob finish. That seemed to be enough. Everyone turned their attention to Bob. Bob went on detailing his plan, but my mind couldn't leave the house-sized object. As soon as he mentioned the grain field, I knew what the traders wanted. My ship. It explains the Delanium and why they need a large army. A ship using a chameleon shield is hard to find. You have to walk right through the shield to see it. I could see Alora and Tanbit figured it out as well, but Grinfo, Drock, and the Nakwaks were as clueless as the blonde in a dumb blonde joke. How are we going to explain a ship to them? Will Kleber allow us to even look for it? I'm guessing that revealing a ship to the locals breaks their laws. This whole thing just got super, super complicated.
The Last Voyage of Commander Jenkins by Lawrence M. Bates. I open my eyes. It's light out. Then something that sounds like a Chopin nocturne starts ever so softly to intrude upon my still half-awake, still half-asleep consciousness. I begin stretching to get the kinks out, only to find my elbows banging against the side of my crypt. Oh, yeah, right. I'm Joshua Jenkins, the captain of the starship Montmartre, on a colony prep mission. All the hoses and med devices and such have been retracted from my body, and the lid to my pod has been popped open by Roslyn. Hallelujah! That means we're in orbit around Kurioki 3, and it's time for me to snap into action. It also means, as the realization suddenly dawns upon me, that I'm still alive. The revival protocols kick in, and I sit up to self-check for brain fog and atrophied muscles. The Advanced Life Support Hibernation Module, ALSHM, a.k.a. Crypt, a.k.a. Pod, is supposed to handle all the biological necessities for us while we're in stasis. It must have worked, because I actually feel pretty good. This must be my lucky day. I step out of the crypt without any wobbling, and sure enough, over in the corner, right where I left it, hangs my captain's uniform. It's a red jumpsuit with an insignia that reads Commander Jenkins. But by my lights, the starship is still a sailing ship, and I'm still this ship's captain. After getting dressed, I finally notice it. According to protocol, we're all supposed to be reawakened at the same time, in case something goes wrong and someone needs help. But The pods of my 3-person crew remain unopened. I walk around the crypt room and inspect each pod. They seem to be operating normally, with all vitals showing in the green. Something must be wrong. Rosalind.
Yes, Commander Jenkins.
I can't resist. Would it kill you to call me Captain Jenkins instead of Commander Jenkins? You know I hate that.
No, Commander. Calling you Captain Jenkins instead of Commander Jenkins will not result in my death or in any way disrupt my power supply. Did you enjoy the Chopin-themed revival procedure? That was one of the last orders you gave me before entering stasis.
Ah, yes, that was fine.
Good. That means that aspect of me is still functioning properly.
What the hell? Rosalind, why did you revive me and not the others? Aren't we in orbit around Kuroki 3?
No, Commander. I encountered an anomaly which requires the Commander's attention. Please proceed to the bridge. I have a brief waiting for you there.
Okay, on my way. Wow, a problem that needs human intervention. Scratch that. Commander intervention. As I walk down the corridor, my mind starts racing as to what kind of anomaly would short-circuit a ship mind. It's supposed to be able to autonomously handle just about any contingency that the universe can throw at it. I'm used to Rosalyn and her eccentricities, but now I'm starting to get a little nervous. I reach the bridge doors and am admitted by Rosalyn.
Rosalyn, as you can see, I'm here. What's going on?
The main viewing screen pops into life. It shows a simulation of the Montmartre as it travels through space from Earth towards Kuroki 3, a journey of some 320 light-years. As the Montmartre gets to about 20 light-years from its destination, the simulation freezes.
For 6 months, Rosalyn begins, the voyage of the Montmartre has proceeded without any significant incidents. Then 2 days ago, the ship attained zero velocity and remains immobilized with respect to this sector of the observable universe at the location indicated by the red pulsing dot on the screen.
That's impossible, I say. You can't just stop in space.
Agreed. What has happened to the Montmartre is impossible. I have spent the last 2 days checking my systems for faults, but have found none. All my instruments report optimal functionality. I have tried using the attitudinal thrusters to maneuver and change our position, but to no effect. I then tried restarting the latent drive on low power to see if that could get the Montmartre moving. But our position remains unchanged. Somehow, we have been frozen in place, and I have been unable to formulate an explanation, let alone a remedy for this phenomenon. In a case such as this, default protocols demand that I revive the commander and seek human assistance.
I'm so shocked by this that I almost fall over backward before managing to recover my balance. Now I need to recover my emotional balance. 2 months behind us is the Red Swan, carrying thousands of colonists expecting to wake up and move into a makeshift habitat that we're supposed to have already prepared for them. Will they get stuck here too? My psych profile says that I excel at inhibiting panic and focusing on problem solving. That's one of the reasons why Space Lab made me a ship captain. More importantly, my psych profile also goes on to state that I've been evaluated out as a high IQ, ultra-rational sociopath who doesn't interact well with other human beings in what is classically referred to as a mentally healthy manner. This serves to amplify my predilection to make decisions based on mission priorities and not personal relationships. In other words, Space Lab made me a starship captain because
I'm a first-rate, well, you know, and everyone else knows it. Rosalind, something must be wrong with your senses. This just can't be happening.
Yes, Commander Jenkins, either I am broken, or the universe is.
I instruct Rosalind to try slowly revving up the engines to full power. We don't move either backward or forward. In fact, alarms go off as the engines start overheating.
Commander Jenkins, I must turn off the engines or they will explode in 17.3 seconds.
A latent drive explosion is not anything you want to be around.
I wait another few seconds just to make sure, but nothing changes.
Rosalind, power down the engines.
Yes, Commander Jenkins.
I then order Rosalind to revive my crewmates and instruct them to assemble in the dining room in 2 hours' time, giving all of us a chance to settle into wakefulness. Arriving a little early is Padak Ramanotra, a physicist, tall, lanky, even regal in bearing. He grabs himself a coffee and sits down at the table. An attempt at small talk is made while we wait for the others, but it's soon abandoned. Oddly, when we talk physics, we get along just fine. Thankfully, a few minutes later, Susan Orman and Lee Sung wander in together, chatting amiably. After all, they're expecting this to be a pre-planning session for exploring and colonizing Kiryoki 3, and are excited about finally getting the opportunity to do just that. Orman specializes in exobiology, and so is by nature a bit quirky and somewhat whimsical. That's okay with me. Space Lab must consider these desirable personality traits in a person that you're expecting to be able to communicate with alien beings. Sung is a planetary scientist. Her disposition sours as she takes the seat and realizes that she must put up with being in the same room as me, at least for the time being. Understandable. Deep space exploration is not kind to fools, and back on Earth during training, I rode her pretty hard while I took it relatively easy on Ramanotra and Orman. She noticed, and at one point she just flat out said that she hated my guts. In my standard charming style, I responded, "Lots of people hate my guts, so don't think you're anything special for it." Sung just humph, obviously unimpressed with my wit. As long as she does her job and follows my orders, then I don't have a problem with her. We'll see. All three possess multidisciplinary scientific skills, and all three of them are a lot smarter than I am. And boy, do I need their expertise now. Padak speaks first, asking, "Where's Kiryoki 3? I don't see it on any of my screens. Shouldn't we be in orbit around it?" At that point, I explain to them the nature of our predicament. As expected, a chorus of, "That's impossible," resounds through the dining room. Then I sit back and wait for the information to sink in and for them to start ideating. Susan asks, "Did you check Rustlin's logs?" "Yes," I say. "Not in detail, but I didn't offhand see anything unusual. 1 minute we're cruising along at latent 12, the next minute we're at zero." Or at least according to Rosalind. Rosalind's been running diagnostics for the last 2 days, and hasn't found anything wrong. That's why she revived me. She doesn't know what to do, and neither do I. Paddock starts thinking out loud. "Okay, assuming that Rosalind is right, here's a few ideas that could explain the stoppage. 1, we've entered a black hole. 2, we've entered a void, a nullity, a region of non-universe where there's no space for us to travel through. Or 3, and this is a long shot, maybe this region of space is the result of 2 inflation fields from 2 different universes intersecting each other, resulting in a patch where the laws of physics that we are used to no longer apply. Rogue black holes are a real problem in deep space, akin to the icebergs that our earthbound seafaring ancestors had to contend with. I said, Rosalyn is designed to detect gravitational anomalies and asteroidal debris and make the appropriate course adjustments. As I said to Susan, a review of the logs contains no indication of any significant course corrections or major incidents encountered during our journey. As for a space void, that's something we'll just have to find a way to test for. During this back and forth with Paddock, Orman and Sung have been whispering to each other. Now, apparently satisfied, they look at me and then each other, deciding which one of them is to present the material. Of course, it's Orman who does the talking. Here's what we think. It could be flypaper or a spiderweb. That's a bit much even for me. That would imply that some creature is going to come along at any moment and eat this ship along with us in it. I reject that explanation because, one, it's too far-fetched for me, and two, if it's true, we're done for. I don't see how the Montmartre can fend off some gigantic galactic starship predator. Orman continues without missing a beat. Okay, if you don't like that explanation, how about this one? It's a border wall, or perhaps a border spear. Some alien races like their privacy, and this is their cosmic beware of dogs sign. Huh. I never would have thought of that. Leave it to an exobiologist to come up with an anthropomorphic interpretation. Or it could be asteroid protection, adds Paddock. Even though there are no planets anywhere near here that would need protecting, still, who knows? All that sounds plausible, I say, but it's an asteroid protection shield. Why are we stuck here? And if it's a border wall, are they studying us? Vetting us before allowing entry? We continue in this vein for another hour or so. One option, of course, is you just go back into stasis and wait to see if something ever comes along to either eat us or collect us for an alien museum. Even if the wall is a naturally occurring phenomenon, subject to dissolution over time, that may be ongoing for millions of years, everyone, including myself, agrees that going back to sleep without knowing what's up is a non-starter. Besides, we sign up for these missions because we want to explore, not sleep. Sung finally finds her voice. You know that you have to notify the Red Swan and tell them to go back to Earth. Yes, I reply. Being overall mission commander gives me the authority to override anyone and anything. I could just advise the Red Swan of our situation and order it back to Earth and dump the problem back onto Space Lab's lap. I've refrained from contacting them yet because I don't want to have to abort the mission until we're positive that we have no other choice. Eventually, we agree on a game plan that hopefully will lead to our getting out of this mess. Meanwhile, the Red Swan is still barreling headlong towards our position. Are they doomed to suffer the same fate as the Montmartre? We spend the next 3 days running tests. If it is one of Paddock's voids, then I can't take the risk of exposing someone to this unknown environment. So first, we have a robot shove a probe out of the airlock. Surprisingly, the probe is able to maneuver around the vicinity of the ship freely. Also, we are able to confirm some cosmological constants such as the speed of light via the probe and Rosalind's instrumentation as well. So it doesn't appear that this is some kind of nullity. Feeling adventurous, we next try extending the probe's radius of exploration. We extend the range to a few 100 kilometers in all directions, up, down, left, right, backward, and especially forward. No problems. Paddock suggests that the wall is mass-sensitive. To check this out, I take the shuttle out for a spin, just in case the wall is life-form sensitive. My spacesuit stays on in case the shuttle gets stuck and I have to hitchhike back to the ship. I take the shuttle out 1,000 kilometers in all directions and encounter no difficulties. The germ of a rescue plan begins to form in my mind. But I'm going to need Rosalind's help first. I return to the ship, go to my cabin, and lie down. Rosalind?
Yes, Commander Jenkins.
Is there a way for the shuttle to rendezvous with the Red Swan before it gets stuck here as well?
No, Commander Jenkins.
Why?
A message to the Red Swan ordering it to shed velocity will take approximately 4.4 weeks to arrive. That gives it approximately 2.5 weeks to match the shuttle's velocity for docking and then set a course for return to Earth before getting stopped by the wall. There is no way the Red Swan can slow down enough or the shuttle travel fast enough to meet the Red Swan at that critical point. Now it's my turn.
Rosalind, if the shuttle is located a safe distance away, would the shock wave generated by a latent drive explosion boost the shuttle to the velocity needed to be picked up by the Red Swan and also leave enough time for it to reorient itself on a course back to Earth before hitting the wall?
Ah, purrs Rosalind. She spends a few moments performing astronomical calculations.
Yes, Commander Jenkins, that is possible. The optimum scenario has a latent drive explosion that would actually propel the shuttle past the oncoming Red Swan as it slows. This gives the Red Swan ample time to turn around, build up speed, and recover the shuttle on its way back to Earth. Another pause. Commander Jenkins, you understand that in order to detonate the Montmartre by overheating the engines, you must be physically present in the bridge to override my safety protocols.
Yes, Rosalind, I understand. I assemble the crew once again in the dining room, explain to them my plan. They shuffle uncomfortably in their chairs for a moment, and then Paddock says, "To be truthful, Commander, the three of us have also come to the same conclusion. We just never believed you would approve it."
Well, consider it officially approved. You have 1 hour to pack your shuttle with your personal belongings along with a couple of weeks' worth of food. The sooner you launch, the better the odds are of your rescue. Get moving. While the crew is off busily packing, I make my way to the bridge. Rosalind pre-programs the shuttle's flight path. I send a data packet to the Red Swan's ship mind. It orders the revival of Commander Strasburg as well as containing all the maneuvering instructions needed to avoid the wall, rendezvous with the shuttle, and return to Earth. There's nothing to do now except wait for the crew to finish loading the shuttle. The intercom crackles. "Commander Jenkins, we are ready for launch."
"Very well," I tell them.
"Rosalind, launch the shuttle. Let me know when they're in position."
"Yes, Commander Jenkins."
The intercom crackles once more. It's Sung.
"Commander, I just wanted to let you know that I still hate your guts."
I can't tell if she's being serious or getting sentimental on me.
"Good," I reply.
"That means you won't experience any psychological damage from this incident."
The connection goes dead.
I've got some time to kill, so I kick back, relax, and put my feet up on the console. "Rosalind, play the Chopin piece."
"Yes, Commander Jenkins."
I try imagining what it must have been like for seafaring explorers of the past, like Cook and Columbus sailing off into uncharted waters and unknown dangers. After some time, Rosalind interrupts my reverie.
"Commander Jenkins, the shuttle has now reached a safe position."
"It's time." "Oh, well,
The captain always goes down with his ship. Rosslyn, disable all safety protocols. Bring the engines up to full power.
Aye, aye, Captain.